Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tighe.
And I'm Bonnie North. These have been contentious times. This week's election showed deep divides in the state and in the country. And earlier in the show, we talked about the debate over the direction of Milwaukee County.
The landscape for our next segment is no different. A new book takes on an issue that cuts to the very core of who we are as a culture. We're talking about writing, grammar, and style. Steven Pinker is a leading expert, maybe the leading expert, on the intersection between writing and cognitive science, and both figure heavily in his new book, The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. He joined us in the studio recently. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I want to start with the double meaning behind this title. Sense of style can mean a couple of things, both of which are really relevant to what you write.
Absolutely. It could mean sensibility, as in a sense of humor or what parts of the mind respond to a well-crafted sentence. I also intended it to contrast with nonsense, because there's an awful lot of nonsense out there about good writing. And the book tries to get beyond the nonsense, to ask not just what should a writer do, but why should a writer do that?
Well, and much of what you do is in the area of cognitive science. Can you connect the dots for us? What does the study of cognition have to do with grammar and writing?
Everything, because language is a product of the human mind. The process of reading and the reactions that a reader has are cognitive processes. And what we know about how the mind uses language is highly relevant to what makes a sentence easy or hard to understand, what makes a passage coherent or incoherent. In order to become a good writer, you've got to be an attentive reader. That is, as you read something that gives you pleasure, stop for a moment, linger on the passage, and reflect on why it gave you pleasure. Is it the rhythm? Is it the choice of words? I suspect that all good writers have a history of having done that in order to polish their own mastery of writing.
But maybe from here on out, some of the best writers, when you ask them what style guides they rely on, will say the sense of style.
I'm hoping so.
It is interesting to consider all the double standards and inconsistencies you point to in what many people think of as, if not the gold standard of style manuals, certainly one of those that they hold dear, the elements of style, a Strunk and White's classic. Do you think as people especially concerned with language, are we more indebted to the book itself or the idea of the book?
There's some of each, because I think a lot of people don't realize how much nonsense is in the elements of style. Now, let me just, for the record, I like the elements of style. I think it's a wonderful little book, especially for its time. I think it's well worth reading today. It's got a lot of little gems, like the prime directive, omit needless words, which is an excellent example of itself. There's certainly no needless words in that dictum. And there's a lot of charm. E.B. White was nothing if not a charming writer, as we know from Charlotte's Web and Stuart Little. On the other hand, there's an awful lot of obsolete advice in there. The authors who were both born in the 19th century had no feel for how the language was changing. And a lot of words that were innovations in their time, which they declared were pompous and slang and newfangled, like, you know, to fix, meaning to repair, to contact, to finalize, they thought were monstrosities. Now it's hard to wonder what the fuss was about. Also, some of the advice is just baffling, like never use words of number with people. Never say three people. Only say three persons. What? My favorite is the word clever means one thing when used of people, another thing when used of horses. A clever horse is a good-natured one, not an intelligent one. Now, that, by the way, was never even true of the use of clever in their era, other than in the few pockets of Maine where E.B. White spent his summers.
Well, and it would be tempting to imagine your book as a reaction to the imminent demise of the written English language. You practically can't go a week without seeing someone who has complained that texting and social media have contributed to the downfall of written English. But You would argue that that's not necessarily the case, or if it is, English has always been under imminent demise.
Yes, that's right. Funny thing, Howard, it's always deteriorating, and here you and I are having a conversation over the airwaves, so no one can see our hand gestures, but we like to think that we're getting some ideas across. So the language couldn't be in that bad a shape. And yes, in every decade, every century, people are always saying that if things continue, the language will be in tatters, and it does survive. And electronic media, I think, are a complete distraction, a complete red herring. Yeah, you write Twitter, you write tweets in 140 characters, but no one's holding a gun to your head and saying you may not write in any form other than Twitter for the rest of your life. People write postcards. They write notes on the fridge. They do all kinds of things that depending on the need, on the audience, and on the medium. And so the fact that we have another medium now doesn't mean that we're incapable of using language in any other way.
Any more than the typewriter had that effect.
The typewriter, the telegram, the postcard. We forget that in the early decades of the 20th century, postcards were kind of the email of the day. Big cities had mail delivery often four times a day. And if you go to a flea market where they sell antique postcards, you'll say things like, yes, we're on for coffee today at 5 on a postcard with a stamp. So even short, not terribly stylish messages of the kind that we associate with email are nothing new.
If the written language then is not under immediate danger of collapsing under the weight of tweets and text messages, what is the compelling reason to write a style guide today?
Writing is hard. It always has been hard. Very few people master it naturally, and I like to think there is advice to be offered, and that advice can be grounded in what we've learned about language over the last 60 years. And we've learned a lot. We've learned we have better grammatical analyses of the constructions of English. Instead of porting over pedagogical grammars from Latin, which is how all the traditional guides are based on, we now understand how a relative clause works. What is the is because a preposition or a conjunction or a subordinator. So that's one bit of knowledge. Another is comes from laboratory studies on what makes a sentence easy or hard to understand, what makes a phrase confusing. And another comes from just the psychology of communication. One of the biggest lessons in the book is that to write well, you have to overcome the curse of knowledge. This is a phenomenon that we're all subject to, where once you know something, it's extraordinarily difficult to imagine what it's like not to know it. We can't recover our original stage of innocence before we learn something. As soon as it's in our brain, we imagine it's in everyone else's brain as well. And so writers who are accursed by the curse of knowledge will fail to spell out the abbreviations or to explain the jargon or to lay out the missing steps or to give concrete details so that readers can imagine what they're imagining because it just doesn't occur to them that other people don't know what they know. And it's only when you take conscious steps to overcome the curse of knowledge that you realize that what's obvious to you may not be obvious to anyone else.
And you're right. This is where academic writing often goes wrong.
Hoo boy, yes. One of the spinoffs from the book was titled Why Academic Writing Stinks. It's an essay adapted from the book. And I think it is a scandal that the people who, for a living, disseminate ideas are often the most inept at conveying them. And one of the reasons that there are cynical explanations like, you know, many academics have nothing to say, so they try to dress up the banal and obvious with pseudoscientific verbiage.
There is a great cartoon that accompanies this book that makes that point.
Yes, one from Calvin and Hobbes and another from Doonesbury. And I don't doubt that that's true of some academics some of the time, but I know scientists and scholars who have nothing to hide, no need to impress, perfectly down-to-earth people, and still their writing stinks, and largely because of the curse of knowledge. They don't know that the jargon that is part of their little clubhouse and that they've grown up with since they were graduate students is not known to equally intelligent people who happen not to be academics in their field.
The other idea that was kind of revelatory for me in this book was the notion that passive voice is not as bad as we've been led to believe.
Yes, every style guide says avoid the passive voice, and it is certainly true that academics overuse it. On the basis of the analysis which was performed on the data which were collected, it is concluded that the null hypothesis can be rejected.
Like, sound of head hitting desk.
Yes. Like, please, sir, I didn't do it. It was done. And you also see it in legalese, and you also see it in the evasive non-apologies from politicians, like mistakes were made. On the other hand, it is not true that to make prose better, you should convert all the passives into actives. The passive voice would not have survived in the language for 1,500 years unless it had a function. And its function is it allows you to put the acted upon or the done to at the front of the sentence. And sometimes you've got to control what goes in the front of the sentence. Holding constant the meaning, who did what to whom, you've got to play with which word gets mentioned first. And if, because of the context of the conversation, it's the acted upon that has to be mentioned first, the passive is the way to accomplish it. So if you say, you know, see that mime over there in the park, he's being pelted with zucchini. if you say, onlookers are pelting him with zucchini, the onlookers somehow make an appearance out of the blue when our attention has been on the mime. It's much more natural to use the passive there because we're already looking at the mime, and now he is the object of the actions, the target.
And all of us are left with an entertaining mental image. You read a lot about the idea of classic prose. What is the significance of classic prose in written English, and why is it so important?
It's a concept that I borrow from Mark Turner and Francis Noël Thomas, and to characterize a style that we often associate with a well-crafted essay or review or book. And it, in classic style, prose is a window onto the world. That is, the scenario that we imagine is that the writer has seen something in the world, the reader has not yet noticed it, the writer positions the reader so she can see it for herself, and the style is conversation. And there are many other ways to write besides that, but that's the one that I think resonates with us as good essay writing. And from that image of what writing is trying to accomplish, a lot of many more specific bits of writing advice just follow automatically. So if you keep that image in mind, you don't have to memorize another dozen do's and don'ts. They all come from that, having that as your goal.
So in reading this and in listening to what you have to say, one is tempted, he says, suddenly using passive voice. I'm tempted to go back and go over everything I've written with a fine-tooth comb and wince. But you would contend that we might not necessarily be so hard on ourselves.
Well, I actually think it's a good idea to go back over things you write and wince before you hit send. That, in fact, a lot of advice on writing is really advice on revising. The reason is that none of us is smart enough to both get ideas down on the page and have them read properly. Because we plonk ideas on the page in the order in which they occur to us, that's not the order in which they're best absorbed by a reader. And so having at least one pass, ideally, you know, four or five for writing that you care about, after having set it aside long enough that it's no longer familiar and then rearranging it in an order that makes sense to a reader is a key to good prose for most of us. I mean, there are columnists who manage to bang out 800 words, hit send, and then they go home for the day. Most people are not like that. What I do advise, though, is that not to take every last pet peeve or dimly remembered lesson from Miss Thistlebottom's English classroom and assume that it is a law of the English language, because there's an awful lot of nonsense floating out there. A lot of cases where some smarty pants will say, you made a grammatical error there, and it's actually the smarty pants that's wrong and you might be right.
The one thing I will say about Strunk and White that still makes it rise to the top, it fits in your back pocket.
And this does not, I confess.
Steven Pinker, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Steven Pinker is the author of the new book, The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century.
Pinker is professor of psychology at Harvard University and is chair of the Usage Panel for the American Heritage Dictionary. He was in Milwaukee to talk about his book at Boswell Book Company. And that's Thursday's edition of the program. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Don't forget, you can revisit any of the segments from this or past shows at our website, wuwm.com. And I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Right now, it's 11 o'clock, and keep listening because fresh air is next.